ladies, gentlemen, and everyone in between. It's the Tom Ragu Sit Down Comedy Show, the place where comedians come to chat about current events, pop culture, and every comedian's favorite subject, themselves. And now, here's your host, Tom Ragu.
Oh, we're on. Okay. I love my theme song. Do you love the theme song?
I love your theme song.
So welcome to the very first episode one edition of the Tom Ragu Sit Down Comedy Show. I'm your host, Tom Ragu. The Tom Ragu Comedy Sit Down Comedy Show is a place where comedians come to talk about pop culture, current events, and every comic's favorite subject, themselves. So I hope that this is the first of a long line of comedy podcasts, and I'm pleased to welcome my very first guest, my good friend, the fantastic and funny Robin Fox.
Thank you, Tommy.
And of course, normally there would be applause.
Oh, yay! I'm your first. I feel honored. I'm your first.
Now we go back a long way. Now, first of all, you appeared on Nick Mom's Night Out or Mom Night Out.
Mom Night Out. Makes no sense.
It makes no sense. I renamed it on my TiVo because it just made no sense. And also, you won the Ladies of Laughter 2012 Comedy Festival.
Comedy competition.
Yeah. And so that's fantastic.
That was wonderful.
I went.
Did you see me?
I was there.
You were at Gotham?
At the Broadway Comedy Club and then at Gotham.
I was like a blur. It was a complete blur.
Yeah. It was great.
Even though I was crying hysterically, I was very happy. Yeah. When I won, I was very, very happy.
Now, you and I, we go back a long way because you were one of the first comedians that I met when I first started doing comedy in late 2006.
I was at a therapy?
Yeah, it was at Therapy Bar in New York City, at Adam Sank's old joint there.
Electroshock Therapy.
The Electroshock Therapy Comedy Hour.
The best drinks.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great show and a great
psychotic
place.
Episode. I remember the drink I used to drink there. It was a great name.
Here's the thing. I begged Adam to put me on the show. Not really begged, but I really don't think that looking back on it now, I was ready. You know, I really don't think that I was ready. I sent him an email. I looked up gay comedian in New York City, and his name was the first one that came up. So you know that you're a big queen when you Google gay comedian in New York City,
and you're
number one right up there. And so I emailed him, and I sent him a 5-minute tape. It was an actual VHS tape.
He can be brutal. He can be brutal.
And his first response back to me was, "I saw your tape, and I really don't think that you're ready." And I was like, okay. And he did give me some constructive criticism, which I accepted, and I thanked him. And then about 3 days later, I don't know what happened.
Maybe
he reconsidered, or maybe he thought, you know, I was given a lot of opportunities. Maybe I should give this new comic an opportunity. I don't know. But he said, why don't you come down on this particular day in November of 2006? And I was nervous. I was so nervous. And you were there that night.
What year was that? Do you know?
2006.
So that's how long I know you.
Yeah. And so you were there that first night. It was you, Pat Galante, a couple of other people, maybe Adam Lehman, Brad Locally. They were all there.
7 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it's been about 7 years, yeah. And so that was the first night that I met you. You were so incredibly supportive. And every time that I've been there, you were there. And then you would say, do you need a lift? I'll drive you to the train station.
Yeah,
and we would be driving for, you know.
I know what you're going to say. We would drive for 5 minutes, and then I'd sit in the car and talk your ear off for like another 2.5 hours.
Right, and it's like 1:30, almost 1 in the morning. And I've got like another hour to go to get back.
The trains are going
to
stop.
And
I can now talk an echo. You know that now, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's you're the perfect guest to have. And so thank you so much for coming.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I really do appreciate it.
It's in Jersey. It's easy to, yeah. And I have a car. I drive everywhere. And I love you.
So, oh, I love you too. And you can find Robin on robinfoxcomedy.com. Now, I really think that there are two types of kids. Like there's, growing up, there's the shy kid who really is very introverted and doesn't talk much. And then there's the future comic clown, class clown type. So what type were you?
I was weird. I was learning disabled. So I was kind of shy in some respects, but I was hyperactive at the same time. I probably now we'd say it was ADHD, you know, or ADHD or whatever. I wasn't paying attention when they gave me the diagnosis. But But I remember in first grade having to sit all day in my chair and finding it absolutely impossible to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I sometimes would just like walk around the chair and then I get yelled at and I'd sit back down and raise my hand like I have to go to the bathroom just so I could go in the bathroom. And I would just take that toilet paper that I never knew could come, like, you know, rolling paper out of the thing and just play with it and just anything to not have to sit all day. And but then I remember that I remember in fifth grade there was a boy and he was the class clown. And everybody loved him. And I remember looking at him and saying, I want to be that. I don't know. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to make people laugh yet. But I remember thinking, I want that kind of attention. And so I really didn't become a class clown, I'd say, until high school, like junior, senior year, and taking some improv classes in high school they had and being really funny then. But high school, college, then I became the, you know, now at the lunch table, I'm going to make you have your milk come out your nose. That was, you know. By the way, in the schoolyard vernacular of comedians, milk out your nose is like a standing ovation. That's like you know, that's the key.
How old were you when you first realized that you were funny? Now for me, the jury's still out on that one. But for you, I know that you're funny.
I remember going away to summer camp and getting, you know, having people laugh, you know, getting girls to laugh. But not really that much because I had a lot. My family life was kind of a big upheaval most of my childhood. So I'd say I knew I started to really sense I was funny my senior year. I was smoking a lot of marijuana, making a lot of stone people laugh in high school and then in college. In college, I saw she has black hair, she has green eyes, and she's funny. It became like part of who I was, you know, but, you know, just as who I was, not as anything, as, you know, professionally.
Who were some of your childhood inspirations? Like, what were you, when you were a kid?
Who did I find funny?
Who did you find funny? What TV shows did you watch?
I absolutely loved I Love Lucy. And it used to come on at 10 o'clock weekdays in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was a kid in school, they were trying to teach us time. I remember looking up at the clock and realizing I knew how to tell time because I saw the clock was at 10 o'clock and thought, I'm missing Lucy. That's how I know. So I loved her. We used to watch The Sullivan Show. In our cave back in the Stone Age, my father would, you know, scream, "Come downstairs! There's a Jew on TV!" You know, because it was very Toadie Fields. I loved her because she, you know, she was chubby, and I always had amazing. A weight problem, and she was funny, and everybody loved her, and she just had, we say in Jewish, a neshama, a spirit that was just funny to be. It wasn't even her jokes, and I've watched a lot of tapes of hers. She's not really a jokey joke person. She is just a funny personality.
Yeah, she was one of those people that you, when you put your eyes on her, you just couldn't take your eyes off.
Oh, she was great.
She was incredible.
Mike Douglas, too. I remember she came and she went to Fredericks of Hollywood and she had bought a fake ass, a thing to make your ass padded. And she goes, "This is the craziest product. You know, no Jewish women are going to be buying this product." And I remember rolling on the floor laughing, you know, loving her. And I liked Phyllis Diller, but I didn't get all her jokes, but I liked her.
Right.
And I remember she used to say she was ugly, and I didn't think she was so ugly. It was very, you know, that was weird to me.
Right.
If you're going to say you're ugly, you better be heinous, you know. Right. But who else did I like? I liked, when I got into college and high school, I mean, I fell in love with Gilda.
Mm.
I mean, she was my, like Wendy Williams says, she was my friend in my head. She was like a relative.
Right.
She was like she was my best friend that I never met.
Yeah.
Loved her.
She was incredible. Did you see any of the old Joan Rivers?
I love the original face, you know. Yeah, and she was also on Ed Sullivan. I liked her. I thought she was funny. I actually came to love Joan Rivers in the days of when she when she had her talk show that went off the air. I liked her. I liked that Joan. I liked the 80s Joan, I guess it would be.
Right.
That was my favorite, the shoulder pads Joan. Pre and post first plastic surgeries.
Right.
You know, when she used to do Elizabeth Taylor, she's so fat, her blood type's ragu. But can I tell the joke?
Sure.
We had a, there was a roast, and Tom was one of the people on the panel, was an Adam Sank roast. And I went up, and you make fun of the other people there, and I go, "Tom Ragu, he's so fat, his blood type is Elizabeth Taylor." And that is, like, still to this day, one of my jokes I am so proud of. And you and I are the only people who understand that it's funny.
Right. We were the only people who were laughing. They were like, "Who's Elizabeth Taylor? Doesn't she do that perfume?"
Like, yeah. I know.
So you've done a lot of gigs, obviously. You've been doing comedy for a while now, right?
I'm still like struggling to know the date exactly. I think I started because I did improv for 4 years before in a local community thing. But I think I started in 2002. mm-hmm. in May. Mm-hmm. So this is I'm in my 11th year.
Right. Now, you don't have to name names, although I wish you would. But what is the worst show that you've ever done, or the worst place?
The worst show, it's very vivid. The worst show I ever did, I was invited to do a woman's 70th birthday party at a restaurant. And the room was like a really tiny, tiny room. And this isn't something that they pulled right before I'm supposed to start. And I think it's going to be just a girl's afternoon. All of a sudden, it's like, you know, they want to get their money's worth, so they tell all the men to come in, too. And now they're standing all around. And, you know, and I'm in this little tiny room, and this woman's 70 years old, and she's not paying attention. She's a real hit. These are all, like, very fancy. They tell me how rich they are. Well, we have a house in Chester. We're on 22 acres. And I'm thinking, I didn't get enough money for this. But I start doing my act, and it's like these privates can be very, you know, have a lot of custom material about, you know, age and her and things in her life. And the phone rings. It's her phone rings. And she goes like this. Puts her finger up and she goes, can you hold it for a moment? I have to take this call. And she started to, the room comes to a standstill, like 30 people. No, there wasn't 30, it was about 20 people. And she goes, yeah, huh? Oh, yeah, but my daughter made me a party. Oh, listen, you know, and the daughter goes, Mom, can you come in? You're being rude. She goes, listen, my daughter's starting in with me. I got to go. And she hangs up. And she goes, continue. Wait, so I continue, and she's doing, like, I think she's texting or something. And I tell a joke, and the room explodes. And she goes, excuse me. I wasn't paying attention. Can you tell that joke again, please? And that was the gig I hated the most. I wanted to run her over and back up like 50 times. It was like, you know, and everybody liked me, and people apologized later on for her. But that, to me, was like the ultimate in just, you know, I felt like, you know, circus performers get more respect, and they have a union, and they get benefits and health and dental. You know, it was just the worst.
Those gigs like that are terrible. The worst one that I did, it was a while back, and it was at Otto's Shrunken Head on the Lower East Side on East 14th. Okay, and I'm in this person's show, and no one has showed up. So it's eight comics, and then a couple walk in. So it's two audience members and eight comedians. And I say to the guy, "Are we going to,
proceed,
or is it? Are we going to call the show and we could
proceed.
Go home?
Of course, and the show must go on.
The show must go on for two people. And so
I've done those.
Right, I've hosted those old Tom Ragu comedy review shows at the Stonewall. Sometimes they were like that. You know,
Mary Domino,
two people.
Mary Domino and I did a show, two people. Mary got up, starts performing. She closed. I was the opener. She was the closer. Two people. It was two comics, two people. And one of the women got up to go to the bathroom in the middle of Mary's act. Mary yells, follow her! And then when we got paid, I'll never forget, Tom, it was like $50. I go, Mary, you're the headliner. You get 30, I get 20. Because I was supposed to divide the money. Yeah, this is it.
That's exactly what happened, is that, so I'm doing my thing, and all the comedians, you know, are on their phone, or they're going through their notes, and they're in their head. Comedians don't pay attention to a show. That's the worst audience that you can ever have, which is why I hate going to open mics, because you think, oh, you know, the room is filled. Meanwhile, it's 21 comedians and five real people. So these two people, they're paying attention. Suddenly, one of them gets a text, and she's doing, so now I've lost 50% of the audience. And then the other one gets up to go to the bathroom. Now no one's paying attention to me. You know, if I wanted people not to pay attention to me, I would have Thanksgiving dinner at the Ragu House. You know what I'm saying? So it was just, so that was like, that was the worst show that I had ever been in. That wasn't my show.
I have actually on camera, I videoed, when, you know, in the beginning how you video, you figure, I'll learn, I'll watch these videos, you know. Mm. You learn how delusional you are. That's what you learn from those videos usually.
But no, I learned that I have like five necks that I need to get rid of when I watch those videos.
I videoed myself at the Stress Factory in an open mic. And nobody, it was one of those sets that literally nobody was paying attention to me. On the video, you see people walking by, people getting up in droves and leaving. The Stress Factory would get like 40, 50 people, right, besides the comics, because it's in a college town. And I'm just doing my whole thing. And I go home and I show it to my husband the next day. And my husband says to me, you're going to make it. I go, from that, he goes, what amazed me was you just kept going. You were, it didn't matter. They had very little to do with whether or not you were going to do your set or not. You just did it. And I have to tell you something. I really think, I didn't realize at the time, but sometimes that's what it takes. To like, mm-hmm. like the audience doesn't even matter. You just are up there and you give your 100%, and, you know, and you're bulletproof. But I was just delusional.
No, but sometimes it is a mindset, don't you think? That sometimes if you visualize that you are going to do well, whether it's this night or this career or this job or this relationship, if you visualize and go in there with a positive sense of self-belief, you can actually make it happen.
I think, yeah, you're probably right, you know, because when nothing happens, if you think, a little sidebar here, which everything is, I remember, and I've never been able to make this a joke, but this is funny to me. When I was in college, I was like a shut-in. I used to just stay in my apartment, in my room in my apartment, and watch TV for 20 out of 24 hours a day. That's what I did. And overeat. That was pretty much, and study here and there. You know, commercials came on. There was no DVR to fast forward. Yeah. So then I studied. So anyway, and my friends say, hey, Rob, why don't you come with us to the Greek restaurant? And we'll, you know, and so-and-so and so-and-so will be there. And what I would do is I would project what I thought I was, what the afternoon was going to be like. And I'd say, oh, and I'll go and nobody will talk to me and I'll come home and I'll be depressed. And I'd say, no. And I'd stay in. So I did get what I projected because I didn't go and I just kept myself fixated. You know, I would make a projection that seemed so bad that it just seemed better to stay there. So it's really much better to see yourself out there doing things and making things happen because then you'll maybe turn the TV set off and start a life again.
Right.
Yeah, sorry.
When I in those very first few years, I mean, I would have – when I would think of – getting up on stage at, let's say, Gotham Comedy Club or some of the other bigger clubs, the gastrointestinal problems that I would have, it was just not able to be believed. And I would literally sometimes have to drink an entire bottle of Pepto-Bismol just to get on stage.
You did the shits?
Everything. The shits,
you ever have a phantom?
The stomach would be turning. I felt I would have to time when the last meal was. It was almost like having an eating disorder. And then I would just visualize. Somebody suggested, why don't you just visualize doing an amazing job? And that was what happened. And then suddenly, like 9 months passed, and I realized, you know what? I don't actually get the stomach problems anymore. Everything seems to be okay. Like it just went away. I didn't think about it, and it went away.
I suffered from right before, about a half an hour before I'd have to perform, thinking I had to go make a number two. And then I would sit on the toilet, and nothing would be delivered. And it'd be the most hard, and they'd be like, Robin, you're on in 5 minutes. I'd be like, I'm coming. I'm in the bathroom. And I talked to Mary Frances Conley about it one day. She goes, oh, you had a phantom. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, that's when you think you have to go, but you don't have to go. She goes, all the best comics have phantoms. I was like, oh, wow, I'm going to make it then. This is a road to stardom. They went away. I stopped having them. But
yeah, oh. It goes away. What's one of the best gigs that you've ever had?
You know, funny, what makes the best gig? The best part of a gig for me is usually the best of any gig is when I get the email or the phone call, would you like to do such and such? That's always the best part, you know, them wanting you. And the second best part is leaving knowing you did really well and getting paid. You know, everything in between is just a lot of work and anxiety and, you know, and fun. But I think the Nick Mom was for me just it was a dream come true because they really don't hand out like candy spots on television for 50-year-old women.
Right.
And so I was over the moon.
So that was a lineup of a whole bunch of people, and you filmed in Times Square, right?
We filmed in the same studio that they used to do TRL. You know, Totally Request Live, right in
MTV.
There.
Uh-huh.
And they had a stand. There was a big window that looked out on Times Square, and there was a big billboard that said Nick Mom.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me my mark. I was the first comic on after Judy Gold, you know, was the host.
Right, so Judy Gold host.
And I'm standing there, and they say, this is your mark, and then Judy's going to, you know, introduce you. And when I'm standing there, I look over to the left at the billboard that says Nick Mom, and not realizing it was a Jumbotron billboard, you know, an electronic one, and all of a sudden it said Robin Fox. And that flipped me out. It flipped me out. And, like, I go up on stage, and literally I'm just looking at my name in Times Square, and it's like, they're going to have to stop tape because I was, like, mesmerized.
I think you even mentioned it.
I did. I go, this is a big deal for a housewife from New Jersey.
Yeah, right.
And because it was the most incredible thing.
What do you think of these Real Housewives of New Jersey on Bravo? You know, you mention all the time that you're a real housewife.
Yeah.
Or you're a housewife from New Jersey.
I
know a lot of housewives from New Jersey.
Yeah.
And what do you think of these Bravo Real Housewives of New Jersey?
I've never seen them wash a dish or vacuum. So I'm highly suspect. And some of them aren't even married. And some of them don't even, you know, it's crazy. You know, it's, no, they're all married now. But I mean, Danielle was on, she was divorced, you know, which counts too. But what I like the New Jersey ones very much. I'm particularly enamored with Caroline Manzo because she's so strong-willed and, you know, she, I mean this in a nice way, Caroline, if you're watching or listening, she is a woman who I don't think has that much going on for her, thinks the world of herself. And I really, we can all learn from that. You know, like she's just like so, she thinks she's great. You know, she used to say, I don't like you till I like you. Did you see that? Did you say that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that blows my mind, you know, that you have to start out her hating you and then work your way up to her maybe tolerating you to maybe one day liking you. And I do a joke. I go, my slogan is, if you like me, I love you. Because I'm full of insecurity. But no, I like them. I think that.
Do you think that they have any Kohl's cash in their pocket?
Any Kohl's?
Kohl's cash.
Because all
the Real Housewives I know, they have Kohl's cash. They're expecting great things.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sure, you know what? I bet you they have a Bed Bath & Beyond coupon for that 20% off. I mean, that goes...
Do they go to the Children's Place?
No. No, absolutely not.
Babies are us.
No.
They irritate me. They irritate me.
Well, you know, I think it's the whole Sopranoing of New Jersey.
Because it's all this. It's all this. Everybody's in the face, and it's all this, and it's this. And
oh, there's a lot of that shit going on in Housewives.
And everybody has their finger in everybody's face.
In real life, it's like that.
Nobody talks anymore. Nobody wants to work out. Listen, let's have lunch, and let's work out our differences.
Oh, no.
Because I really respect your presence in my life. No, it's not that. It's this, and it's this, and it's this, and it's this.
It is
and
that.
And then suddenly, wigs are flying, champagne is being thrown in the face.
And that shit really does go on, Tom. I was home with my kids for 17 years, and the meanest people I ever met were other moms.
Mm-hmm.
They are out of their friggin' minds, and they're nasty, and they will pick up your kid and hit you with them if they knew that it would hurt you. And I really do think that's accurate. The thing I don't like is I think that since The Sopranos was on TV and portrayed New Jersey and the mob and that whole Italian, you know, tough guy kind of mm-hmm. thing, there's just between the Jersey Shore kids and the Real Housewives, I think they're portraying Italian Americans in a kind of guttural way that isn't fair. And I think what's happening is it's translating to the kids that they're acting like, you know, that they're, you know, like you have kids who are living in $500,000 and up homes acting like they're from, you know, the streets of Brooklyn, you know, and their dad is a pizza maker or something. And, you know, their father is the CEO of a major corporation, you know, and so it's that I hate. I hate that. I don't like the dumbing down, you know.
Yeah, it just irritated me. Well, anyone who knows me knows that I'm a major Donna Summer fan. I mean, anybody who knows me, I know I have all the albums. Donna Summer was the first person that I fell in love with. My first record that I ever bought, back when they were making vinyl records, was Donna Summer record. The first concert that I went to was the Bad Girls 1979 tour.
You really loved her.
So I loved her. My father loved her.
That's nice. You have to share that with your dad?
Yeah. Yeah, no. We all loved her as a family. It was really weird, you know? I mean, some of the first noises coming from my record player, the little Fisher Price
Love to Love You Baby.
Ah. Right.
Yeah.
And all of that. And my mother didn't like that song at all. Mama Ragu, the famous Mama Ragu, didn't like that song at all. And she would come into the room when I would play it, and she would break the record. So I would then have to go to the Five and Dime or Woolworths.
And I bet you didn't even know what she didn't like about it yet. Because how old
no.
are you?
I was, well, then if I tell you, then you'd be able to figure out how old I am.
And then you have to kill me. And then I'd be dead.
No, I was a young kid. I was a young kid.
Grade school kid?
Yeah. Let's
so
say.
You didn't know. You didn't even know about
orgasmic
singing.
I wasn't even in grade school. I was like 6, 7, 8 years old, let's say.
So you probably thought she just was in pain. Like she had like a bad back.
No, I thought she was like, oh.
Love to love you, but I can't get up off this chair.
I'll get it tomorrow. Love to love you.
I threw my back out. I hurt my foot.
So here on the Tom Ragu Sit Down Comedy Show, we are going to have, and by we, I mean me. I always talk about myself in the third person. The Donna Summer video of the day.
And so this is an ongoing thing.
So this is an ongoing thing. This is going to be every time. And do you want to know that I'm Facebook friends with Donna Summer's husband, Bruce, who's also from Brooklyn. And I asked him, would it be okay if we played a Donna Summer video of the day? And he wrote back almost immediately. I was very surprised. He has apparently nothing going on. No, he's got a new band.
He was waiting for that email.
No, he's got a new band, and he's traveling around. He's
that's
got
good.
Lots of different things going. There's a new album out.
I didn't know he existed, so that's
but
interesting.
He wrote to me, and he said, oh, yeah, sure, that's no problem. I'm sure that would be great. So every podcast is going to be a Donna Summer video of the day. So today's video of the day is the Chromeo and Oliver remix of Love is in Control, Finger on the Trigger, which is from the new Love to Love You, Donna CD that came out earlier this month. And so let's hit that video and let's take a look, and then you and I will talk about it later.
Sure.
So Love Is in Control, Finger on the Trigger.
That was a very, you know, it's good, but it's
a great, so that's the new video, that's the new song, it's the first song off the new album, Love to Love You, Donna, which you can probably get on Amazon and whatever. I got mine. I bought 5 copies.
And one for every room in the
house?
So
everybody knows what they're getting for Christmas. It's the new album. And so that's the remix by Chromeo and Oliver. So what do you think of the video and the song?
I love the song. I remember the finger on the trigger part of the song. I don't remember that, you know, lose control part. Is that the new part, the love control that they put over?
No, that was always there.
I don't know why.
So this was the album that it was produced by Quincy Jones, and this was the record that Quincy produced before, right before Thriller. And so you got the Bee Gees in the background, and you've got and there are a couple other releases from the record State of Independence, and Woman and Me, a couple other songs. I know basically everything there is to know. So this album and the song was originally released in 1982. And it's the new. I really should be like a radio DJ.
No, you're like
a radio
man of Donna radio. Summer.
I know. I am a very good music student. And so that's it. So, do you have a Donna Summer memory or a favorite disco memory?
I remember the first time hearing "Love to Love You, Baby," and just being like, you know, you'd want to sing along, but how do you sing along? But I loved it. It was, you know, hypnotic. It was kind of like Bolero of the disco era. You know, it was like kind of just sucked you in. And I just loved her. She was like the queen of disco.
Right.
You know, she just, and it was like, that was my college years. And, you know, it's when you start dancing. You know, those are my dance years. And I loved her. She just had a huge personality. And we knew nothing about her back then. I mean, she was just this person who would come out and sing these great songs. It wasn't like today where, you know, with media, you know, and TMZ and everything. We knew nothing about Donna. She just came, entertained us, and then went back to her cloud, you know, where she lived.
And then Never Neverland.
And then I remember I was the happiest moment. My happiest Donna Summer memory was when she did "Enough Is Enough" with Barbara Streisand, because that was like two universes colliding into one just.
Right.
You know, amazing moment.
That was an amazing time for me. Look, can I just tell you?
Tell me.
Okay, I was 10 years old. Okay.
The delight on his face.
I was 10 years old, and I saved my allowance, right? Because I think I got $5 a week or whatever it was.
Oh, you're a big, rich boy.
And so I would go to the record store, and I would see this 12-inch single of the Donna Summer, Barbara Streisand, "Enough Is Enough." Release.
Yeah, they had 12-inch singles. I remember.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was on the radio thing, and it was on her Bob Streisand's album. I think it was "Wet" or something like that. And then they released a 12-inch single, which was like a 17-minute version of the song. And so I saved my money. I had never. I heard of Barbara Streisand because my parents, of course, listened to her, but I'd never visually seen what she looked like. And I think that was the case for a lot of kids, and there was that was the case for a lot of people who were Barbara Streisand fans. They had heard of this person Donna Summer, but they really never knew what she looked like. And so it was an ingenious duet, because it really was the bringing together of two icons who are at the peak of their careers at the time, doing this amazing duet. And I really don't think that there's been a duet since that has really, you know, topped the charts or influenced a generation like that song influenced my generation.
Oh, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And, you know, of course, I was just recently looking at the pictures, and of course, Barbara is on the right-hand side, so her nose, you know, doesn't...
Good side.
Her good side, yeah.
As if there is a good side. Anyway.
But, yeah, it was great. And you know what was good is that Donna really held her own with Barbara. Because Barbara, you know, being the queen diva, you know, Donna really, really held her own.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Well, there's this story, there's this folklore that when they were in the studio... And I think even Donna Summer wrote about it in her autobiography, Ordinary Girl.
Of course.
I know.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. And so they're in the studio, and there's this big long note that is supposed to be carried for many, many bars, right? And Barbara, it's no problem. But Donna Summer was struggling to keep up, and she fell off of the chair. But Barbara Streisand just kept on singing until the end of the note. And then when it was over, then she said,
Are you okay, dear?
It's like, that's a complete diva move.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, that's one of those old stories. And apparently, you know, it ended up being true because that's what Donna Summer said.
So it has to be.
Okay, so this is crazy website. It's called eatwith.com. All right. And what you do is you go onto this website and you can either host a party or you can go to a dinner party, and you register. And if you are hosting a party, you can say, like, I want 20 people to come, and I'm going to charge X amount of money between $20 and $60.
You don't know these people?
Right.
And strangers just show up to your house.
Strangers show up to your house. Right. You charge $50 at the door, and you feed them. And I'm assuming, you know, it's going to be like a major thing, dinner party. And that's the thing.
And then they come and they rob and they rape you, and it's a nice night for them.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's my question. Would you ever?
No.
I wouldn't either.
I don't even want to have my people I know come to my house.
Dinner party for 20 people, charge $50. And then wouldn't it be horrible if then they serve franks and beans and mashed potatoes?
I have to tell you, Tom, as not only a housewife in New Jersey, but a Jewish housewife in New Jersey, I belonged in my mommy years. You have to do fun things, you know.
Right.
And so us Jews, we do things like I joined Hadassah.
Mm-hmm.
I made a progressive dinner, which mm-hmm. is basically what you're talking about. And you have appetizers in one person's house, and then they break you up and put you in another house, and you have dinner, and then you go to another house for dessert. And so we went to a woman's house, a lovely girl, but she decided to serve brisket, which was very nice. But brisket is it's something you get, you know, if you're a Jew, you eat that every holiday, brisket shows up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to progressive dinner. Come to the dessert. You go into people's, you know, so what did you have for dinner? Oh, we had filet mignon, and then one woman had scallops. It's what Jewish scallops. She had scallops, and we had brisket. So I know I've been to this party, but it was just called Hadassah Progressive Dinner.
See, I've been to this party too. It's called a restaurant, and it's regulated by the Board of Health. If I want to eat with strangers, I'll go to a restaurant where it's all regulated. Nobody's coming to my house.
They'd be lucky to come. I'm a good cook. They'd be lucky to eat dinner at my house. I make nice stuff, but I don't know. I'm not going now.
Yeah. So there's another website called diedinhouse.com.
Now I'm interested.
Okay. So for $14.95, you can register and find out if someone, let's say you're interested in purchasing a home, if someone actually died in that house.
Oh, you know what I thought he said? I thought he said, diet in your house.
Yeah. Well, basically.
No, diet, like losing weight
in
your house.
In your house.
You said die in your – you want to find out – I moved into an apartment where a man had died in the bedroom. And I lived in that apartment. It was in Cranford where I grew up. I got an apartment in the same town. And I couldn't sleep in the bedroom for the first 6 months. It just freaked me out. I slept on the living room.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't go in there.
Yeah, I lived in a condo in San Diego where I thought that the place was haunted. I saw ghosts, you know. And then I just realized it was the shadows of the men coming in and out. But I mean, no. I mean, I think that this is...
You're bad.
The cameraman is laughing. So the thing is, this is an actual thing. This is an actual website where you pay $14.95 fee, and it's crazy.
Another reason to buy new construction. Okay.
Right.
Then nobody died there.
Unless
they build it on top of a cemetery, you know.
So the Kardashians' life is not good. I think that the world is slowly becoming a better place now because the empire that was the Kardashians is collapsing. Keeping up with the Kardashians on the E! Channel this is their last season. They canceled the show.
I better start watching. It's ending and I haven't even started. I didn't want to keep up with them.
Right. I actually couldn't keep up because they all look alike and they all have that same voice. Khloe, oh my God. I just couldn't take it. I couldn't take it. And I was not able to tell the difference between Khloe and Kim and Courtney. Everybody has a K. Then there's Chris and then there's just too many.
I just didn't like them. I viscerally, when you sometimes meet somebody and you just go, this person's not for me. I just knew that these were girls I would relate in no way, shape, or form to. I was a frumpy, dumpy girl from New Jersey, and these were girls who were trading just on their looks and their ability to give head on film. did you give head on film?
Yeah.
You know, and I just really, and I just didn't connect. I just didn't
with care. And she did that with Whitney Houston's ex, Ray J. Who is the brother of Brandy?
Wow.
That's a little trivia that's not Donna Summer trivia.
Yeah, wow. Yeah,
that's
just,
sex tape trivia.
Yeah, I just really was not I'm more interested in people that can because I always like people that are famous and I think, well, if I maybe did that or had that talent or could do this, I might have that too. You know, but when these people I hated them.
She's one of those people that just became famous for nothing, like Paris Hilton.
At least she was a Hilton.
But what did she do?
But she was at least a Hilton, she had a good, she had a pedigree, of some sort. But the Kardashian, so her father was the one who got OJ off. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. if he was the guy who convicted OJ, I would have, maybe liked her more.
And the mother, Kris Jenner and Bruce Jenner, after 23 years of marriage, they're separated. the talk show, Kris Jenner talk show, didn't do well, so that's not getting renewed. It's really a new day in TV because they really have ruled TV for a very long time, and it's a really good day, at least in my life.
Ding dong, the witch is dead.
Yeah, a couple of them are dead. You know.
Now that was Ryan Seacrest.
That was all. Yeah,
you could blame
you could blame Ryan Seacrest and her production company for doing all that because he's responsible for the Kardashians and all the spinoffs.
And the OC too, right? Didn't he do the OC also?
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
He's got a lot of things going.
Somebody has to stop that boy before.
Yeah. So there's this stuff. There's this. Thing that's going on at Barney's of New York that's been happening lately.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, it was front page news on the in the papers in New York. So there are a couple of people who went shopping at Barney's. There's one guy bought a $350 Ferragamo belt, and paid with his credit card, and the name is on the card. And they say, can I see your ID? And the name, matchy matchy. And then they put it in a bag. And he walks out. And the security guard gives him, the business about, is this your card? Is it stolen? How did you get your money? Do you have a job? What kind of job? Did you steal this? And then again, very shortly before that, this young girl, she bought a $2,300 Celine bag, which I had never even heard of a Celine bag.
I have. There's nicer bags for $2,300. Okay.
her card, her money, and I don't know if it's the same security guard, but it's the whole thing. Do you have a job? Did you rob this card?
I thought the black boy guy man. When he left the store, the police actually pulled him over. I thought it was they stopped him.
The security guard was an undercover or off duty police officer.
Oh, okay.
And then he called the detectives because he did what anybody would do. You know, what do you care, security guard? I paid for this. Here's my receipt, and I'm gonna go and leave the store now.
And what is he? Was it the thing that I don't understand? Because I know a little bit about how credit cards work. You know, is it that if they approve it at the store, and they can ask for ID sometimes. I've had that where they've asked me for ID to make sure it's my card. But in the end, the credit card company is the one who has to be worried about this, not Barney's. Barney's will be paid regardless by the credit card company. So is this just that they're outraged that a young black boy can afford a $300 belt?
I don't know. It's crazy. Let me just tell you something. If you or I walked into Barney's and I bought under a momentary, time of insanity, a $350 belt. I don't know why I would buy a $350
belt. To hang yourself. No. It's not even funny, but go ahead.
They wouldn't say, can you afford this? Do you have a job? They would say, is there something else that I can help you with? I think that it's just a complete racist move. It's just such a low-class racist move for...
See, I've been Pretty Woman. You know, this is beyond Pretty Woman. This is pretty profiled. You know, this is beyond. But I've, walked into stores where they've been like, can I help you? Not that there's anything here that would fit you or look like you can afford, you know. Especially at Bloomingdale's, I'll walk in like, you know, excuse me, you know, what do you need? And I go, yeah, bitch, where's hardware? You know, because I just, you know, it pisses me off. But, you know, and I think it's, I still don't understand what the thing for the security guard, for them to, like, what is the benefit of Barney doing that? Truthfully, you know, people using other people's credit cards in their store, not the worst thing for them, you know? It's the shoplifters where they don't get the cash.
Right.
They got paid.
Right.
So I don't get it.
It's crazy. And it just outrages me that we're 13 years into the new millennium and we're still at this place.
But how about all the places that buzz people in based on profiling? You walk up and if you look like, you know, you have a knife in your back pocket or you're crazy, they don't buzz you in.
That happened to Oprah. Did you read about that last year?
Yeah.
And it was in Paris at the Hermes store.
Yeah.
I love it. No, this happened to her twice.
Yeah.
It happened once here at the Gucci store where she was with Gail. And, you know, she wasn't done up as Oprah because if you see Oprah with the hair and the makeup and everything else, you know who she is. But when she's not
Oprah. She looks like Sophia.
Right.
From The Color Purple. She does. When she's not made up, she looks a little haggard.
Right. And so she's with.
Don't we all?
And she was with Gail, whose wig is always on a little crooked anyway. And and they show up at Gucci and they wouldn't let them in. But this also happened in, I think, Paris at the Hermes store. And she and there was a $3,500
I know, it was like about 7-8 months ago. It wasn't that long ago, right?
No, it was over the summer. And I just think if you obviously have the money, I don't understand what the whole thing is. The whole thing also in New York, they're doing a whole lot of this stop and frisk policy. In New
if
York.
They're stopping that, I think they said they had to stop that.
No, it's still going on. It's still going. It can't stop until we have a new mayor. Let me just tell you that if I were to walk up and down 125th Street in New York, I could literally have drugs falling out of my pocket, money in my sneakers falling out. Nobody would stop me at all. It's just complete racial profiling. It outrages me.
Racism's alive and well. I mean, it's. Yeah. I mean. It, you know what? Where I really see racism the worst, whenever there's a story on Yahoo that involves a situation like this, or the president, or any person of color, and you read the comments. Boy, the white hoods come on really fast, because the anonymity, people, the things people say, and it was a real eye opener for me, because you know I kind of live in this bubble, like everybody likes each other, everything should be nice, you know, and I see that like the hatred, it's just right under the surface.
Right. And people hide behind, you know, a keyboard and a monitor, and they say the most mean things to you.
Beyond
because
me.
They can't see you. Why don't you come over here and say that to me?
Absolutely.
It even happened to me all these years ago, and I wrote a joke about it. I had this video and this about Kirstie Alley. Remember I used to do all
I
that stuff?
I love that, yeah.
And some woman wrote to me, and she said, "Don't make fun of Kirstie Alley. You look like you eat a hamburger." And
you used to talk about this on stage a lot.
Right.
Yeah, I love
Cara DiCabello was her name. I even remember the woman's name.
Rotten hell.
Right. Cara DiCabello.
Yeah, but who's holding a grudge? Go ahead.
Right. So I don't hold a grudge, and I don't remember her name. But I mean, they would write the most hateful things.
I had recently my on a YouTube clip I had, it was from for a clip that I had up in case somebody was looking for a Jewish comedian, you know, so I could show people. And somebody like called me. I forget what it was. I Facebooked posted about it, but I think they called me like not funny Jew bitch, you know, kike da da da. And I was like, really? And then I kind of felt though, Tom, seriously, I felt like I made it. I have a hater.
Right.
You know, it was like
somebody hates me. They took the
time.
They took the time to hate me. So one of the other things, one more story that I want to talk about before we talk about what you want to talk about is last week it was front page news that Lindsay Lohan, who we all love, I mean, the kid is a talented kid, but she's got an addiction problem. And so it was front page news that there was this grainy paparazzi photo of her reaching for a drink. And so my question is, do you think that it's possible for a person in the public eye to actually get sober?
It's been done. It's been done. I think it's a daily struggle for people. You know, addiction's like I struggle, you know. I mean, a cookie can put me down on my knees. You know, I mean, it's a struggle for people. And I just think that she's got to take herself out of the public eye for a while. She's got to just go off and get her crap together. You know, it's gotten to the point now where people are saying, well, was she? It's really people are even questioning, was she talented now? Like, you know, because she was a kid then. So it's like, it's, you know, she's getting into that Shirley Temple phase. Like, yeah, you were cute when you were 19, you know, 10 to 19, but what have you done that shows any major talent at this point? So she really needs to go off in a corner,
yeah.
I think. You know, for her own sanity, hopefully she has enough money in the bank that she can live comfortably. But I think she's addicted to the fame. I think she's addicted to the partying. But I wish her well. It's a personal hell living with addiction. Every day to have to wake up with it, go to bed with it, be disappointed. You know, it's just not good.
I can't imagine trying to get clean in the public eye with the way that the paparazzi follow you now and TMZ. And every false move you make, you have 15 people photographing you. She was at her friend's backyard or something, like, you know, up on a balcony. And she was reaching for a bottle, and we don't know whether her friend said, "Hey, can you get that for me?" And just at that moment, they took a picture. It would just be impossible because the paparazzi and the press and all the websites, all those fan websites, they take everything. Out of context.
But on the same thing, she's got to stop Googling herself and looking at it and knowing it. She needs to remove herself from all that public stuff and maybe stop going to the parties where the paparazzi would be. You know, maybe just like, you know, have like a brunch with some egg salad and some little sandwiches with your girlfriends, you know, just, you know, just like maybe have like a movie, rent some Netflix, you know, she needs to like take it down.
She needs a gay friend. And I volunteer myself. I'll be your gay friend. You call me. You know, or just reach out to me on my website, www.tomragu.com. Go to the contact page. Contact me. I'll be your gay friend. Anytime you're in New York, we'll go have brunch, Sunday brunch at Market. We'll do whatever you want to do, Lindsay. You need a gay friend.
And you know,
someone who really cares.
Yeah, and that older Jewish mom is always nice too. You know, that person who you can cry to. If you need to cry, you can call me and cry.
Right, robinfoxcomedy.com.
Yeah,
call Robin. Okay, so every podcast, I'm going to have a segment where I briefly turn over the reins, if you will, and turn over the podcast to whatever esteemed guest I have that week. And do a segment called What Do You Want to Talk About? So, Robin Fox, what do you want to talk about?
You know, if I can out-talk an echo, you know that. But I've said that before today. But the thing with me is that it's very hard for me to come up with, you know, something that's really burning. But the biggest thing that's happened just recently was I bought my first pair of boots. I've never – not there aren't snow boots or, you know, or slipper kind of boots. I mean, I bought real grown-ass lady boots that like with the zipper because I've never had them because I could never find a pair that went over my cankles. I never could. And it's been like – you know, it's like one of those things that's like, you know, well, I'll never be a supermodel and I'll never wear – boots. It was just, you know, I put that to rest. And then yesterday I was out shopping and they said wide calf boots. And I went, oh, really? That's what you think. You know?
Where was it? Wide calf?
Wide calf boots. So I looked for my size, almost daring them to have a size 9.5. They had a 10. I tried them on and they zipped. Hmm. And I bought them. I didn't even care. They could have been $5,000. I would have like, you know, ask that black kid where he got his fake credit card. No, I don't know.
Don't go Barney's.
I'm kidding. I'm not going Barney's. Can we take that out, Pat? Now I'm a racist. I said, no, I mean, I would have bought them. I would have gone into hock. Now I'm panicking. No, but I bought them and.
So have you worn the boots?
I bought them yesterday afternoon.
You know, a little something.
No,
are those
shit kickers? They're high heels. They're like these boots were made for walking.
And so, what does the husband think of the boots?
He hasn't seen them. Matter of fact, I posted on Facebook yesterday. I bought my first pair of boots.
Right.
And he comes downstairs. He goes, "You bought boots?" So he's out of, but I'm just thrilled to own them. And it's a nice thing, because when I was a kid, my mother boots were very big in the 70s. At one point, all the Brady girls had them. And they didn't even live in a snow zone. And they had boots. And right. My mother wanted to buy me boots and hot pants, you know, because I didn't get picked on enough, you know, so I needed to have that outfit. And so she got me the hot pants and, you know, that didn't go well. But so I went to try to buy the boots when I was a kid and none of them zipped, none. And they didn't have the term cankles back then, but I basically used to say my foot went from my thigh to my ankle in the same width all the way down. Right. And I would call them thankles. You know, I was this close to having a name, you know, thankles. But, I'm delighted. I didn't wear them today because I thought this was only radio. I didn't know it was going to be on TV. So
Surprise,
yeah. I have a face for radio, you know. This was...
So do I. So your kids are out of the house, right?
Yes. It's wonderful.
Are you happy?
Yes. You know, just not to have to like worry about dinner every night because everybody wanted different things, and it's a lot more peaceful. I love them and I enjoy them, but
you would make different things?
I'd be forced to because my daughter was like, she didn't eat anything. My daughter didn't eat anything with tomato sauce on it. My son only liked things that were deep fried or junk. And my husband wanted everything healthy. Everything had to be very healthy, low fat, so that he could eat a low fat, healthy meal and then sit and eat potato chips and ice cream later on in the night and piss me off because I made this low fat, wonderful meal and now he could eat that.
Right.
And then, you know. And
when I was growing up, my Mama Ragu would make that was what was for dinner. And if I would have like a little tantrum and I didn't want anything, she would say, well, that's what's for dinner. And if you don't like it, you could go to your room. And I would be punished then for not liking, like she would make like, let's say, liver and onions.
Yeah.
Not exactly my favorite meal.
Not on the children's menu in too many restaurants. Yes, right. I understand.
But she would make it, and that was what was for dinner. And if you don't like it, go to your room. As a matter of fact, go to your room now. And I would be punished. I was going to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that would be it.
That was my house growing up, too. But because my husband wanted something different, and my daughter also was getting very skinny. And so I would, and as a mom, especially when, you know, with all the anorexia and fear of eating disorders, I would just try to come up with something that I knew that she would eat that would give her nutrition, because she was this thin, but she was hyper concerned that she had the genetics of her mother, I guess. So, you know, she was careful. And so it started with kind of her and my husband and then my son. And it was just, I'm happy. I don't deal with that anymore.
Right. Well, that's great. And you have a puppy at home, too?
I have Sammy.
Sammy?
Yeah.
And how old is Sammy now?
Sammy is now 5 years old, and he's wonderful. He's like he's 5.5 pounds. He's tiny, and he's got a person. He has no idea that he's a little dog. And then my husband retired, which was, he does some investing in other things. He works, and he manages my career and my daughter's photography career. But it's that's a challenge, having him there. Because I was home for 17 years every day, 27 years every day, with nobody there. My favorite day of the week was Monday, when they all went to school, went to work. And now it's always him there. And I love him, and it's great. But it's, I do this joke, and it's true, it's like being on Breaking Bad with cameras on you. I'm constantly under observation. He watches my every movement. I was out in Baltimore this weekend, and he drove me down there, and I did a show down there, and I'm with him. So we like to be with each other, but it's just a different adaptation of life, having him there.
That's good. It's good to have somebody supportive.
Yeah.
But if that were the situation with me, I would want that person to just, you know, edit the videos, let me take care of my side. Like, there would have to be clear roles.
Oh, there are. He does all the paperwork, and takes care of all the accounting and stuff like
the
that.
Because
I'm a total fuck-up with that stuff. I mean, I literally, I don't know how to say this. I mean, money is important to me as anybody else, but, like, I would sometimes put a check in my wallet after a show. I completely forget to cash it, like, for 4 weeks. And it's like, that's like, when he would, like, you know, he'd say to me, do you have change of a five? I go, yeah, it's in my wallet. And he would go in there and go, there's a check in here from 6 weeks ago. What, are you crazy? Why is it in there? You're going to lose it. You're going to lose it. And then, you know, I'd say, I'm not going to lose it. He goes, how do you know? You must have lost, like, 10 of them by now. You don't even know. And so I let him take care of it because it was less annoying than to hear him do that. And he's good at it.
That's great. So before we end, because we're coming to a close, what I thought that would be interesting is something called the Quick Eight. And so we're going to do 8 quick-fire questions.
Like the Actor's Studio.
Right, almost like the Actor's Studio, except I'm much less attractive. And
you're much better attractive than me.
And I, what was it? What's his name again? John?
I don't know. He's creepy.
Yeah. And so 8 quick-fire questions. Just tell me in a couple of sentences or less what's on the top of your head. So who – Robert Fox, who is your celebrity crush?
I'm old school. I'm old school. Richard Gere.
What's your favorite recipe to make?
My favorite recipe to make. Oh, that's hard. Lately, I've been making a lot of branzini. You know, whole fish with the bones and everything.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I love it.
What's your biggest fear?
Weighing 500 pounds and having to have the front door cut out to get me out of the house.
Mm.
And being buried in a piano case.
And then being, a feature on Dr. Oz or something. Yeah. Like having Dr. Oz come and do it.
Yeah. But if they put, like, Robin Fox comedy on there, maybe. Can you imagine doing stand-up from your bed? Hey, hi. Welcome to my bedroom. And who gives you that food? Who's feeding you when you can't get out of bed?
You know, it's the enablers are doing it. You know, the friends, the family. They had a segment on, I think it was either Jerry Springer, and he was so, you know, condescending, because you know that he, whoever this person was, he was completely using her for the ratings, and he was just manipulating the hell out of her. And he would go to the house and pretend. I mean, Jerry Springer has like one of the worst shows on television.
Did Richard Simmons do that too? He also found some of these people that couldn't get out of bed. And
yeah, but I mean, I believe that Richard Simmons actually did care about these people. Jerry Springer,
no, it's just pure
yeah. manipulation. And he would have this look on his face like he really cared about what you were going through. And he would then interview the family members. The family members were more than happy to give whoever it was like 7 bags of potato chips and 4 liters of Diet Coke in the morning. Diet Coke in the morning.
Of course.
If you're eating 5 bags of potato chips and,
every bit helps.
And 17,
I get it.
17 stacks of pancakes.
My family wouldn't feed me. Tom, my family would not feed me. But I have an family, and I would have to use takeout delivery service. Right. And I live in New Jersey where I live. There's only one. I'd be eating Chinese food every meal. And she'd come. She came in Hurricane Sandy. She comes no matter. She's very reliable. She shows up. She goes, I have food. She's wonderful.
See, now that's racist.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Oh, boy. This was
all right.
Good.
So what's a job that you would never want to have?
Her job.
Her job.
I don't want to be delivering food. Probably I'd be delivering food and like, you know, I'll just take one French fry out of here. Like, you know, I don't think I'd like to be a delivery person. Truly anything that required me being 8 hours in an office, because now I'm full circle. I'm back in first grade. I'm having to sit in my desk all day long. I cannot do that. Right. I cannot do that.
I did the whole office thing. I mean, I did a lot of accounting work and it was crazy. I was counting other people's money. It was just, I was the worst temp. I worked for a couple of temp agencies. I was the worst temp. And the worst temp job I ever went to. They didn't even bother, because I would last like 4 or 5 days, and then I just got too fed up, and I would email my resignation, and I didn't even go in.
Lucky you, that email then.
Or, you know, or I fax it in. One time I faxed my resignation, and I knew I wasn't coming back. I packed up my desk the
day
before.
You're like Berger on Sex and the City. I can't. I won't. On the post-it. He's not on a post-it.
Right. And so there came a point where they just stopped even getting to know who I was. And they would just call me Temp 4. Like Temp 1, Temp 2, Temp 4. Temp 4, you sit here. Here's a stack of stuff to do. And I would just add up the numbers, and then go home. And it was just so...
Blow me. That sucks.
Yeah, ungratifying. It was just terrible. But I did it for years and years and years. When I first came back to New York, that's what I did. It was crazy. Who's your favorite superhero?
Superman. I love Superman, and I actually had a sexual fantasy about Batman when I was in third grade. I kind of, I don't know, maybe had a bigger package. I don't know, but I love Batman
mm-hmm.
when I was a kid. But Superman, Batman.
Did you see the most recent Man of Steel movie?
I'm a little behind.
Yeah, they redid it over the summer. I didn't see it either. Who's your favorite comedian or stand-up comic?
Right now, I would say Louis C.K. I just I'm in awe of his talent and how much he writes, and of course, you know, he has people coming to see him, so the audience is very accepting of him experimenting. They're there for him, you know. So, but I just think he's brilliant.
Yeah,
I'm on the bandwagon, you know. But
no, he's great, and I love that he does everything himself. There are no middlemen.
Oh, he's done the big reach around. He's like he's had his audience find him. He's not there's not no middlemen anymore.
Yeah. And he edits, writes, directs that show on FX.
Louis. Love it.
Yeah, I mean he does everything himself, and
he films it on his cell phone. You know, I'm only kidding.
His iPhone. Wait, I'm getting a call. But and also all these specials that he has on HBO or whatever, you could go to his website and you could buy them for $5. You don't even have to go to let's say Amazon or iTunes or any of these places.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, and so he just cuts out the middleman. $5.
The end user wins. That's it's a win-win.
Yeah, I love him too. I love him too. And the last question: who's your free pass?
My free pass is Richard Gere. Me and my husband have discussed this extensively. If Richard Gere, for some reason, has a head injury and decides that I'm the woman he must have, and you know, do you know about the Richard Gere move?
No.
Oh, there's a move. It's in every of his early, most of his movies. There's this move where he takes a woman and he has to have her. And he did this in Officer and a Gentleman and he did it in Pretty Woman, where he grabs a woman right at her waist and he bends her down onto like a piano or onto a bed. And when he does that, I completely melt and lose it. I completely, like, my brain just explodes. And there was a movie I saw, and I forget, I think it was the one where he, the wife with Diane Lane, Unforgiven or Unforgivable or something. And, I'm waiting online at Hollywood Video to get it. And the woman goes, She goes, it's a good movie. I go, does he do the move? She goes, no. I go, oh, shit.
Everybody knows the
move. We know about the move. So he's my free pass, and I got to do the hacky line. You know who my husband's free pass is?
No.
My best friend, Sheila. No.
So your husband is okay if Richard Gere, if he just came, you're at the movies and
it's fine.
And he walks into the theater.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you'd be happy to see the engine got started, everything works. You know, it's like you start up in a lawnmower every now and then, make sure it's still,
Well, I had such a good time talking with you.
I am so honored
Did
that you
have
asked
a good time?
Me. I love this.
It was fun. So thank you.
I want to wish you every success, not only in this and everything, but I think this is going to be wonderful. And I'm just so happy I did this, Tommy. Thank you for asking me.
Thank you. Thank you for doing it. And I hope that it's the first of many Tom Ragu sit down comedy shows. This is a podcast. I'm happy to be part of the Broadband Box Office family. And the podcast is also going to be on SoundCloud, Podomatic, New York Comedy World, iTunes. And so we're going to be all over the place.
It's Podomatic.
And so my name is Tom Ragu. Thank you for listening. And if you're watching, thank you for watching. And we'll be back next time. And if you want to learn more about Robin Fox, please feel free to visit www.robinfoxcomedy.com. My website is tomragu.com. And thanks for listening. So be good to yourself, live a little, and laugh a lot. Have a great day.